Windy City Queer Cast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
We're talking mega gay.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm Amy Matheny.
This program is brought to you in part by American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow.
And Miller Lite. Triple Hops Brewed Miller Lite. Taste greatness. Listening to the Windy City Queercast, show number 419. I'm Amy Matheny, and we are officially tipping over into Pride Month. I hope you all had a fantastic Memorial Holiday weekend, and that it was warm, sunny, relaxing, and joyous wherever you are and wherever you are listening to this Queercast. You know, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. As a Tennessee person, I have been shocked and appalled by my state in this recent developments of continuing to promote discrimination against LGBT people. And there has been so much attention on Tennessee, and I haven't said a lot about it, and I probably will say more as things go on. But truly, the people of the Volunteer State and the people of Tennessee are good people and are kind people and are helpful people. And it's a great place to live and to work and to raise a family. And these absolutely discriminatory political jockeying laws that are being made and fabricated in the state of Tennessee are just appalling to me. Measure SB 632 and HB 600 passed the legislature last week before the holiday, and it was created to remove protections against GLBT people in Tennessee and prohibiting cities and counties from enacting discrimination bans. And, you know, there are no state protections for sexual orientation and gender identity in the state of Tennessee. So the governor signing this into law has really set a tone that allows people to start creating more and more awful legislation to discriminate. And, I just think it's a sad day. So many corporations came out against the bill and in favor of allowing workplaces to have anti-discrimination laws. The Tennessee Chamber of Commerce and industry, you know, they changed their position. They had supported the law, then they supported the bill, and then they now oppose the bill because so many businesses came out against it. Alcoa, FedEx, United Health, Whirlpool, Comcast, AT&T, and the state of Tennessee, just near where I live, which was devastated by the recent tornadoes, has enormous new industry coming there. All of the Amazon boxing plants are coming there, as well as Volkswagen is coming to East Tennessee, the first Volkswagen manufacturing plant outside of Germany. So people are choosing to pick Tennessee as a place to work, and we want GLBT people to feel supported and not discriminated against when they go to work for these companies. And I just say, if you're listening from Tennessee, whatever you can do to speak out against these discriminating laws, and I think subsequent things that will come to follow, because a tone has been set, and it has been set from the Capitol. And it's so strange, because Nashville is a pretty liberal place. You know, we all call it the Hollywood of the South, and many people are starting to speak out against this. You'll hear some of them in the news, but more than just members of the GLBT community. So we really need these companies and these corporations to stand up and speak out and reverse what is starting to happen in the state of Tennessee. And on that note, also, it's exciting how much is changing in a positive way, and celebrations happening and abounding all over the world as we head into Pride Month. And there's a freedom of being able to be who you are, to be authentic, to speak your truth, to live your life full of joy, without fear, and held in an acceptance that you will be protected and cared for no matter who you love and no matter what your gender identity or sexual orientation happens to be. And that's really what this Pride Month is all about. But what if that took you decades and decades and decades until you determined that you could live that way, that you could live authentically, that you could live a free life? Well, that is our story today, a new book by a noted psychiatrist. So not only do we get a real expert's opinion and a lot of expert information and resources on the coming out process, but we also get one man's personal journey. That is Dr. Lauren Olson. He's on the show, and his book is called Finally Out, and it really tells a beautiful story of what it is like to come out later in life. Also, we have the GLBT news and what's going on in the theater, plus Richard Knight Jr.'s review of Bridesmaids. My review, I saw it and I laughed so hard my face hurt. And there are other times when my face hurts, but that movie was one I'll really, really, really remember. Oh, everybody, happy Pride. Here we go.
Want to learn to play tennis in no time? Chicago's Midtown Tennis Club has the country's only patented tennis teaching program to turn beginners into players in just 3 short weeks, with sessions beginning June 2nd. During Tennis in No Time, students will learn the basics of the game, including the forehand, backhand, and serve in a fun group atmosphere. Best of all, Tennis in No Time is affordable even in today's economic climate. Enrollment in TNT is $115 and includes a 3-week membership to Midtown Tennis Club, invitations to 2 social parties, and 9 hours of instruction from the country's best pros for only $115. That's less than $20 for each hour and a half lesson. Midtown Tennis Club is located in the heart of Chicago's Lincoln Park at 2020 West Fullerton Avenue. For more on Tennis in No Time, call 773-235-2300 or visit midtown.com/Chicago.
I'm Kirk Williamson.
I'm Amy Matheny.
And this is the Week in News.
In Minnesota, gay marriage will be on the ballot next year as the State House signed off on a proposed constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. After hours of an emotional debate, the House voted 70-62 to put the question to the state's voters. The amendment would define marriage as an institution only for a man and a woman.
In Alabama, House Bill 273, a bill that would protect teachers and other state employees from being fired because of their sexual orientation, is languishing in the legislature. The bill's sponsor, State Representative Patricia Todd, is already describing the bill as dead in the Republican-dominated state house. However, she added that it's important to start campaigning for equal employment rights for gay and lesbian educators.
The majority of Christian Americans oppose the Discriminatory Defense of Marriage Act, favor protecting LGBT people from discrimination, and support anti-bullying laws, according to a new poll released by HRC in partnership with Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research. Also, more Christians than overall population say their faith compels them to believe the law should treat LGBT people equally. Additionally, a strong majority of Christians believe that anti-LGBT religious leaders do more harm than good.
In Texas, District Judge Randy Clapp plans to nullify the marriage of transgender woman Nikki Araguz, whose firefighter husband died in the line of duty, on the grounds that they had an illegal same-sex marriage. Araguz, who was born Justin Graham Perdue, married Thomas Trevino Araguz in 2008 and had gender reassignment surgery 2 months later. Thomas died while fighting a fire last summer. Now his family and ex-wife, Heather Delgado, are battling Nikki for the $600,000 in death benefits and assets.
Frank Bruni, 46, has become the first openly gay op-ed columnist at the New York Times in its 160-year history. He has worked for the Times as a restaurant critic and has had a writing career at the newspaper that has spanned two presidential campaigns.
Three United States Army colonels based in South Korea have been reprimanded for taking part in an anti-gay skit poking fun at new rules designed to protect out gay soldiers. The skit featured the officers using effeminate gestures and imitating Sirs Elton John and George Michael, as well as lip-syncing to a song by Boy George.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development announced it is offering up to $9.1 million to address the critical housing needs of low-income persons and families living with HIV/AIDS, including homeless individuals and families.
In El Paso, Texas, a federal judge has ruled in favor of a voter-approved city ordinance that prohibits health benefits for gay and unmarried partners of city employees, as well as elected officials and retirees. The police union is suing on behalf of a lesbian officer, her partner, and retirees who could lose their health benefits.
Nevada Governor Brian Sandoval, a Republican, has signed Bill 211, protecting transgender people against discrimination in the areas of employment, housing, and public accommodations. The law will take effect October 1st.
In Virginia, four people brutally beat a transgender woman outside a 7-Eleven store in Fredericksburg. In April, two girls allegedly attacked a transgender woman at a McDonald's in nearby Maryland.
The United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit has ruled that transgender woman Sandy Batista has a right to receive hormone medication while civilly committed within the Massachusetts Department of Corrections.
In San Francisco, the Trevor Project, which provides suicide prevention and crisis counseling to LGBT youth, has opened a call center in a former office of the late gay politician slash activist Harvey Milk. Milk was the first openly gay politician in the country when he and then-Mayor George Moscone were assassinated in 1978 by their colleague, Supervisor Dan White.
Virginians are narrowly divided over the issue of civil unions. 47% of Virginians say same-sex couples should be allowed to marry, while 43% are opposed.
In world news, the Church of Scotland, the nation's largest Protestant denomination, has lifted a ban on the appointment of openly gay or lesbian ministers. The church's General Assembly voted to end the moratorium imposed 2 years ago after Scott Rennie became the denomination's first openly gay and partnered minister. The Assembly agreed that openly gay clergy members who were ordained before 2009 can be appointed as pastors. However, it ordered a study, due in 2013, on whether to ordain out gays and lesbians and to allow pastors to bless same-sex unions.
Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil, has banned sex education films with anti-homophobia messages from being produced or distributed in schools. He feels such movies are unsuitable for children.
In Montenegro, people tear-gassed an International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia concert in the country's capital, Podgorica. In response, Pride organizers canceled the May 31st Pride Parade, which was to have been the nation's first.
On the Caribbean island of Grenada, two men have been arrested for having gay sex. The men, ages 41 and 17, could face up to 10 years in prison. While the sex was consensual and the age of consent is 16, the law prohibits unnatural connections. Grenada, which has a population of 103,000, gained independence from the UK in 1974.
And in entertainment news, Chicago Bulls center Joakim Noah used an anti-gay slur during Game 3 of the team's Eastern Conference series with the Miami Heat. Noah used the same slur that Los Angeles Laker guard Kobe Bryant said last month, one that caused him to be hit with a $100,000 fine from the NBA. The Bulls player was fined $50,000. The Bulls lost the series to the Heat 4-1.
Another sports figure has shown his support of gay athletes. NFL Baltimore Ravens wide receiver Dante Stallworth recently tweeted, "Sad that people are ridiculed for their sexual orientation in this age, and leave religion out of this. God loves all."
Janet Jackson, Brooke Shields, and Bill Clinton joined thousands of attendees in risque attire May 21st at the flamboyant Austrian fundraiser known as the Life Ball. Clinton reminded the revelers, many covering private body parts with nothing more than paint, feathers, or G-strings, that a large number of those infected with AIDS still are not getting access to life-saving treatments.
Glee actress Jane Lynch may host the Emmys. If this happens, she would be the second consecutive gay host of the ceremony following Neil Patrick Harris. Another possibility is Family Guy creator Seth MacFarlane. However, there are concerns he may make censors nervous.
Actress/writer Calpurnia Adams, star of Logo's Trans-American Love Story, whose life was depicted in Showtime's film Soldier's Girl, has criticized Tennessee's new law that bans cities and counties from protecting the state's LGBT citizens. Adams said, as a proud daughter of Tennessee, I want people to know that not everyone there supports the recent breathtakingly harmful legislation against LGBT people. And lesbian Grammy winner and Tennessee resident Janice Ian also criticized the measure, saying she has seen growth and diversity in Nashville during her 23 years there.
Openly gay actor Neil Patrick Harris will have a star-studded list of people helping when he hosts the Tony Awards on June 12th in the Beacon Theater in New York. Presenters include Whoopi Goldberg, Joel Grey, Angela Lansbury, Viola Davis, Chris Rock, Alec Baldwin, Kelsey Grammer, David Hyde Pierce, Daniel Radcliffe, and others.
Jeff Conaway, star of the movie Grease and the TV show Taxi, is brain dead and reportedly set to be removed from life support. Conaway, 60, who has long struggled with drug addiction, was found unconscious May 11th. He'd lost consciousness because of pneumonia aggravated by substance abuse.
Actress-singer Queen Latifah is launching a clothing line for HSN. The Queen Collection will launch on August 27th and includes clothing and accessories designed for women sizes 2 through 24.
Lindsay Lohan started her house arrest May 26, but will probably serve only about 35 days of her four-month term. Lohan, who was 24, turned up at a Los Angeles jail, was deemed eligible for home confinement, fitted with an electronic monitoring ankle bracelet, and released to her home. Lohan has been in and out of jail as well as drug and alcohol rehab since 2007.
Glee Live North American Tour will become a film. The film will follow in the wake of Michael Jackson's This Is It and Justin Bieber's Never Say Never and will be released for a two-week engagement starting on August 12th.
And that's the weekend news brought to you by Windy City Times.
This is Richard Knight Jr. with your Night at the Movies Minute. The versatile Kristen Wiig, the Saturday Night Live regular who has a way of making the inane and just plain weird hysterically funny, has worked hard at becoming a movie star. With Bridesmaids, which she co-wrote with former Groundlings improv pal Annie Mumolo, if I'm saying that correctly, as a vehicle for herself, she's finally made it. It's lovely to see this fearless, funny lady front and center at last, and although the movie ambles about and follows a familiar class-conscious template jazzed up with gross-out scenes, thanks no doubt to the participation of producer Judd Apatow, there's a lot to like and laugh at here. Wiig plays Annie, the socioeconomic underdog, trying to hang on to her implied rights as the best friend and maid of honor to Lillian, played by Maya Rudolph, whose surprise engagement finds her stepping up in the world economically. Annie is quickly pitted against the wealthy, passive-aggressive Helen, played by Rose Byrne, the Martha Stewart-like perfectionist who has taken on Lillian and her wedding as a new pet project and keeps besting Annie. Then there are the other quirky bridesmaids with Melissa McCarthy's standout playing a female variation on Zach, oh, I can never say that last name, Galifianakis, you know, the guy from The Hangover. She's a standout. John Hamm is a gorgeous egotist and Annie's friend with benefits, and Jill Clayburgh in her last screen role, who plays Annie's mother, a woman with exceedingly tacky taste. Plot-wise, the movie's really not much more than a female cross between Meet the Parents and The Hangover, but in the hands of Wiig and these deaf comedians, it helps elevate Bridesmaids beyond its male frat comedy counterparts. I'm Richard Knight Jr., and that's your Night at the Movies Minute.
Is it always right to pursue these feelings?
Hey, this is Ari Gold, and you're listening to the Windy City Queercast.
And I know that
Culture Club. Culture Club. Culture Club. Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Queer.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of May 30th, 2011, you are in Chicago's Culture Club. Pride Films and Plays celebrates Pride Month with Gay UK, great new gay plays from Britain. From a new version of the classic Morris to the controversial drama Pig and the off-Broadway hit The Pride, check out Gay UK at Theater Wit June 1st to the 19th. Wednesday, June 1st is My Night with Reg by Kevin Elliott, and Sunday, June 5th is Morris. For more, visit pridefilmsandplays.com.
Lifeline Theater concludes its 28th anniversary season of unforgettable books brought to life with a world premiere adaptation of Richard Adams' beloved novel, Watership Down. Running Thursdays through Sunday through June 19th. For more, visit lifelinetheater.com.
Join Dixie Longay's good old-fashioned Tupperware party in Chicago, filled with outrageous tales, free giveaways, and the most fabulous Tupperware ever sold on a theater stage. NBC Today Show claims it's not your grandmother's Tupperware party. For tickets, visit Ticketmaster.com, extended through June 12th at the Royal George Theater.
Writers Theater presents Heartbreak House, directed by William Brown, a sly and maddeningly modern expert writer's revival, raves Time Out Chicago. The Chicago Sun-Times proclaims Heartbreak House to be unquestionably brilliant. Tickets are selling out. Order yours today at writerstheater.org.
And for more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com.
Hello, Deb Pierce here, letting you know that we'd love to hear back from you. So go ahead. You know you want to. Post a comment.
Yes, you've been on my mind. I've been drifting for quite some time. And this life is paralyzing. This life is paralyzing me. I can't see through the grays. Truth that's been lost in the haze. And I need someone to save me. Truth's all I want. All I want is you. You're all.
Dr. Lauren A. Olson's book, Finally Out, is part memoir about coming out in midlife and part psychological study of homosexuality. And with Olson's distinguished career as a board-certified psychiatrist, he makes the marriage of these two parts of himself, it's just a quite rare examination and illustrates how Olson, along with many in his generation of boomers, stayed trapped in some old belief systems that didn't work for them, and how many of them are continuing to break free and live authentic lives as GLBT people. And so I'm thrilled to have Dr. Olson here on the show to kind of talk to us about his story, about this book that I strongly encourage people to read or to give to someone in their life. Finally Out, Letting Go of Living Straight, a psychiatrist's own story. Hey, Lauren, how are you?
I'm great, Amy. Thanks for having me on your show.
It's great to have you on. You know, it's a story that, you know, we haven't gotten to do a lot of conversation about on the podcast. And more I am realizing that the more mature part of our GLBTQA community definitely is a part of our audience. And we've done a lot about the next 50 years of life and retirement and aging in the GLBT community. But this is a very personal story. And at the same time, you have the foundation of your education and your practice and all of the references that you make in this book that really give this book so much weight. So I just want to say congrats on the book, first of all.
Well, thanks a lot.
Tell me your earliest memory of gay people.
My earliest memory of gay people.
Or knowing that there was something gay in the world.
You know, when I grew up in the 50s, I'm 68 now, Amy, so I grew up a long time ago, and in those days, we talked about sissies, you know, but we didn't, the word gay really didn't come into common usage for quite some time after that.
Right.
At least I grew up in rural Nebraska and spent my educational years at the University of Nebraska. So, I recently had a conversation with a friend of mine who graduated with me in medical school, and I said, when we were in med school, were there gay bars in Omaha? And he said, you know, I don't know. And I said, were there any people in our class who ever went to any place? He didn't know either. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so even when I was in my early 20s, I really was not aware of a gay community.
Mm-hmm. But you just knew of men who were less than men. I guess that would be how you identified them, as sissy?
That's exactly right. They were somehow compromised in their masculinity and not quite enough of a man. And so it was very fearful to even consider that in oneself.
Yeah. And so you did not identify with those men that you were hearing about, or...
No, not at all. You know, I could identify behaviors within myself which were gender nonconforming, you know, mm-hmm. and one of the examples of that was, you know, boys carry their school books with their arm extended and girls typically carry them with their arms bent, at least in my generation when we grew up, that's the way it was. And I would notice things like that, mm-hmm. and I would then begin to imitate the masculine behaviors that, and sometimes people would remind me that my behavior was not gender appropriate. But I was not somebody that would be picked out in a crowd as effeminate or a sissy at that time.
Yeah.
But I also knew that I had to kind of always look over my shoulder and always study the behavior of others. Another example of that was when I was a kid. I enjoyed sports, but I wasn't really obsessed with sports. But I would read the sports page, so I knew what was going on, so I could join in the conversation and feel like I was a participant. And it was as if I didn't know the box scores on the baseball teams, that somehow that would be a clue too. So I'm sure that a lot of that was an overreaction, but at the same time, it was all part of the way I feared somehow exposing this fractured masculinity that I felt I had.
You know, it's interesting because to hear you talk, you know, this is can kind of be the difference of a generational divide where maybe today's if you're listening today and you remember a period of time where you were closeted, you know, I have a lot of gay men and even women say, you know, I knew from a very young age there was something on a conscious level happening to changing roles and fitting in and staying closeted. We call it closeted now. And yet what you're defining is something that is almost subconscious. It's not a conscious understanding of gay and straight, which when I came out to my father, who is a straight man but is about 10 years older than you, you know, his first response to me many, many, many years ago was, you know, there just weren't gay people when I was growing up. And and so you're identifying something that you know, I'm trying to speak a little bit. I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but it's a very subconscious level. It's not the same as someone coming out today who knows there are like options for sexuality.
Yeah, I think that's very definitely the case. You know, I grew up in the 50s, and when I was writing the book, one of the things I wanted to do was to try and put my life in the context of living it, mm-hmm. and to try and see how could I be so stupid not to know. But when I went back and pictured it, I was 10 years old during the McCarthy era when there was this great hunt for communists and homosexuals, and Senator Wary from Nebraska was very involved in that. And one of the interesting coincidences was that Senator Craig, who was caught in the bathroom in Minneapolis having sex, was exactly the same age, and he was from Idaho, and in Boise at that time, there was this great witch hunt for homosexuals, and big headlines about how the homosexuals were going to snatch your children away from you and so on. So in some ways, for me, his saying, I am not gay, is understandable in the context of having shared a very similar life.
Right. Well, and right when you were becoming a man around the age of 20, I assume at that point, you know, it was when you met your wife, and also when you defined where your studies, what your studies and what your work in this world were going to be. You know, you began a relationship with that led you into your field as a psychiatrist, and also led you into a marriage with your wife. Talk to me about that time period around your 20s. You know, why did you go into the work that you went into, and what can you tell us about your the beginning of your marriage with your wife?
Well, I was in medical school during my early 20s, and I remember reading some things at that time, and the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual in Psychiatry still had homosexuality listed as a pathologic or psychopathic deviancy, is what it was called. And when I read that, I thought, well, that can't be me. I can't be gay because I'm not deviant. I'm not pathological in any way. And so I think in many ways, Amy, I kind of became asexual during a period of my time. I dated some, and I was lonely, and I wanted someone in my life, but I kind of didn't know how to do it. And so it was just kind of easier not to date very much. And but then I met my wife, and we really loved each other and still do in many ways, although it's changed. But we were very compatible in many ways. Our value systems were the same. And it seemed right to both of us. And so I entered the marriage with absolutely no knowledge or any suggestion that I was gay when I did get married, and even into the time past the birth of my first child before I had any same-sex contact as an adult.
So it was after what point in the marriage did you start having, I mean, was there a pivotal moment for you of your awakening? That was like slow evolution?
Well, it was both. I think there was an evolution in the sense that when I was about 32, I went to New York City and I met a man that I knew before, and I knew he was gay, and I went out to dinner with him, and knew that he was going to try and get me drunk and have sex with me, and I didn't in any way try and interfere with it. And so that was my real first introduction as an adult. And so that, but I kind of put it away again, but I couldn't put it away in the same way I had earlier. You know, there was this, you know, I had enjoyed it. I was curious about it. So I began to sort of explore the gay community as an observant, as an observer. Then when I was, past my mid-30s, 36 or so, I met a man at the gym. He was also married, and he was from a foreign country. He was a graduate student. And as we were changing clothes in the gym, I noticed he was watching me, and it kind of, you know, kept going about my business. And then he was still watching me and smiling and so on. For whatever reason, I couldn't tell you now, I followed him down the hall, and we then arranged to meet, and we began a relationship. But the time when I really began to say, you know, I must be gay is when he kissed me once. And when he kissed me at that moment, I began to experience sexual feelings that I didn't know existed. I had heard people talk about that kind of feeling, but I had never really personally experienced it in that way. And I don't in any way want to diminish my relationship with my wife during that period of my life. But it was just something that I had heard about, but was a level of intimacy in connection with another human being that I had known. And so then I had to say, this means more than something just sort of casual sex.
Right.
This is about loving a person in a whole different dimension than I ever imagined.
Did you feel like an outsider at that time? Because you said, you know, when this first incident happened around when you were 32 or so, you know, you said, I became like an observer of the gay community, like a voyeur. So you have a heightened awareness, I guess, of
yes,
where it is or where it is in the room or where it's being written about, or any of that?
All of that. I mean, yeah. I began to know that there was a gay literature, that there were gay movie houses, that there was a gay community, there were gay bars where people met. You know, I began to understand that all of those things existed, but I still...
So you knew that on an intellectual level, like at 32, with kind of broadened eyes, but then it went to a place of like the heart and a deeper place with this sexual...
Yeah, you're a better psychiatrist than you know.
I'm sorry?
You're a better psychiatrist than you know. That's exactly what happened. You know, I intellectualized the whole process, and I was a scientist, you know, exploring the underground gay community. And then as I began to do it, I became a participant, and without even knowing that I'd made the transition, kind of. But then it became a matter of the heart and not the head. And when it became a matter of the heart, then I thought, can I put this away again? Should I put this away again? Can I deal with the losses that are going to come about because of this? And that, you know, after I fully recognized that I was gay, then it became a focus on how do I deal with the losses that I'm going to experience.
You're right, because, I mean, to move into this new life, you know, another life has to die. I mean, another life has to end. And so what was going on within your marriage? I mean, and even within your work, I mean, was there such a disconnect until this you know, affair of the heart finally happened? Was there an ultimate disconnect until that point? And then it was, what are the steps I do about, you know, leaving my marriage and all of that?
I was talking with my former wife not long ago about that sort of thing, and she knew there was something wrong in our relationship. She didn't know what it was, and she actually found some stuff I'd written and confronted me about it. And I, you know, being a psychiatrist, and if you believe in the unconscious, you think, well, maybe I set this up to be discovered, and I suspect I probably did. But I wanted it to come out so that I could begin to deal with it in a personal way. The year was 1986. It was sort of in the middle of the AIDS epidemic. Early on in it, anyhow. And professionally, physicians, by and large, were not out. There were not a lot of gay men that I knew who were professionals. And when I left my family, I became medical director of a large hospital here in Des Moines. And so I had a fairly high-profile career, and I had all these responsibilities with financially and so on for a family, and establishing a new practice. And I was extremely fearful of being discovered and exposed professionally. One of the saddest moments of that period of my time was sitting on a committee for an HMO. And they were trying to establish criteria for who would be admitted to the HMO. And there was the woman who presented the information said, we have designed a questionnaire that is the purpose of part of the questions is to determine if someone is gay. And so they could deny them insurance because of the risk of HIV. And I... sorry, I'm emotional about this, but I sat there silently, being unable to speak out for fear of the consequences. And, you know, it was a very painful memory for me because of that time and the fears of losses. And there were other examples of times when there was another action related to another physician, and he threatened to expose me to protect himself. And so there were things like that that did occur. But, you know, as time went on, I went to an APA, American Psychiatric Association meeting, and I found out that there was a whole subgroup of gay and lesbian psychiatrists. And I went to a party I was thinking it would be, you know, 20 people at a kayak. Well, the room was 400 people maybe in there, in the room. And, and so I was quite stunned at that point to know that there were that many other psychiatrists who were gay. And So gradually through the years, I've been out in public for a long time.
Well, and it is true, you know, that deep, deep pain of not being able to live our truths. And I think there have been times where many people, and this isn't even about being gay. It's just if we have a secret of any kind and we think, well, that secret's not, you know, not hurting anybody, or the things we omit to say about our truths, you know, that those are our own and we have full ownership over them. And I know I appreciate you for even just sharing with us, you know, how emotional that is for you. And I'm sure you've done much since that time to do so much for people within the gay community, you know, to, you know, if you felt you needed to amend some sort of silence that you had in that moment. How did your family react? I mean, I think that's always the big thing, that people feel they're going to lose absolutely everyone. And yours is not that story. It doesn't dismiss how difficult the situation was.
My mother in particular, of course, was the person to whom I was closest through the years, always accepted me. I never felt any sense of rejection. And my stepfather was a very traditional male. And actually, he was extremely supportive too. My father had died, my biological father, when I was very young, so I had concerns about that. But I came from a fairly religious and conservative family, and I expected that there would be more difficulty with that. And there has been a little, but I generally have to say that I feel very blessed that the family may not accept some of the things that I've decided to do. And they've always welcomed my husband into their lives, and we've always sort of been able to expand our definition of family to include alternative relationships, so whatever definition. So feel very lucky in that way.
Talk to me about why the idea to tell your story, why the idea to write a book, and it doesn't serve as just a memoir. You have not written just a memoir, even though it is very, very personal. What led to that?
The original thought, it came from an article by Jane Gross in the New York Times about 4 years ago, and she talked about how the older generation of gay men and lesbians were having to recloset themselves in order to access social services. And 4 years ago, I was 64, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm about there. Yeah. And so I thought, you know, that's me. And I said, I may have a very short career as a gay man because I came out at, you know, 40, and now I'm going to have to try and go back in that closet. So I thought, you know, I'm a scientist. I'll research the literature. And and when I did, I found out there really isn't much written about older gay people, and there's becoming more interest in that now, but at that time there wasn't much, and there particularly wasn't much about gay men who come out later. You know, the early definitions of coming out were quite linear. You know, you take step A, you have a sense of difference, and then you acknowledge it to someone else and so on. And I thought, well, none of that is like what happened to me. So I began to question other people that I knew who had been married and came out later, and their experience was not like that either. So I did an online survey, and I asked for participants who did not define themselves as gay, but had sex with men, and self-defined as mature. And it sort of supported my idea that when men come out later in life, that the course of that coming out is anything but linear. It often is sort of bouncing from place to place, and a step out in one community, but maintaining a closeted existence in another part of your life. And so, it's a very complex process. And of course, as a psychiatrist, I'm interested in the emotional pain that these men are in. And I found out that many of them had been through similar things to me in terms of that, and had lived this life of feeling fearful about being discovered, and the networks of families and relationships that they were afraid of giving up, and so that's what led me to begin to write the book. And of course, as we were talking about earlier, initially it was fairly intellectual process, and then I got an agent, and she said, "You know, Lauren, if you want people to read this book, you're going to have to put yourself into it."
Yeah.
And so as I was writing it, I began to do it, and I thought, well, you know, there's some stuff. In order to make it believable, I had to share stuff that I couldn't have shared at an earlier point in my career. I'm sort of on the tail end of my professional career now, and so I thought, well, I can take a risk of sharing some of these things, because I want men and other people who read this book to know that I'm have the experience that I know what that life is like. I know what those underground sexual connection places look like, and to make it really authentic in every possible way.
Right. You show the growth too, you know, because something is truncated, right, in the sexual development of the men or women that you are speaking to. You know, you speak to it as the boomer generation, but I would say that there's a whole generation even after you, you know, that based on community, based on where they live, if they don't live in a major metropolitan city, they live in a small southern town, you know, they don't have to be, they could be in their 40s, you know, and 50s and be dealing with these exact same issues of not being able to live free and authentic lives, and even in, you know, based in religious circles. And there's so many things that can truncate our sexual expression and our sexual growth still that continue today.
I'm very happy to hear you say that, Amy, because I hear a lot of stuff from other people that say, "Oh, it's so much easier now because there's so much more published about it. There's so much more availability of things," and that is all true.
Sure.
But we have to examine the fact that within the gay community, there are lots of subpopulations where it's not true at all.
Right.
For example, many in the immigrant community feel like they have to choose between their ethnicity or their sexuality.
Right.
And I correspond with urban black men in the South and from a rural community in Canada, a school teacher up there. You know, there is still a significant reality that some people find it impossible or nearly so to come out, even though it may be easier. And I don't mean to say that for adult men who are coming out, it's a more difficult process than anybody else, but it's certainly complicated. One other thing I wanted to mention before we close, and that is that I did not mean to ignore women in my book, but I really felt like I needed to narrow the scope to something that I would do something about. Well,
you don't happen to be a gay woman too, so you get to just tell the story that you have, right? And I
hope so.
And I don't think that people won't relate to it, because, as I say, you not only speak from the heart and talk about yourself, but you also, I mean, the format of this book includes so many references, and you are so knowledgeable. You do not claim to be an expert. You know, often when people write a memoir, then we're left with only their word. And we think, you know, if they say something emphatically, then that's the end of the story, that they're an expert. It's almost implied, right? I mean, they're an expert on their story, but they're not an expert on, you know, every offshoot of aspects of their story. So what I like about your book is that it is a marriage of both, as I said in my introduction. You know, this is my personal experience, and then this is what, you know, other people through the work that you do and the colleagues and fellowship in the psychiatric world and even, you know, medical world say about what, you know, about the other issues that as they relate to your life. And it seems that it has changed the book is the most outer example of that, but it's obviously changed your approach to your work, you know, to a far more intimate type of work, I would imagine.
Yes. Yes, and you know, I'm sort of at the tail end of my career now, and I felt it was safer to say those things. But you know, you're saying that what you've just said has really validated my goal in writing the book, and that was to help people understand our lives in a different way than perhaps they have before. And, I felt as a psychiatrist, I had some insight into that, but I also knew what the life was like.
Well, we should say that it's been a very packed, full, beautiful life. I mean, you're very involved in your children's lives and your grandchildren's lives. As you said, you talked to your ex-wife like a couple of weeks ago. You live in the great state of Iowa, so you are legally married to your husband, Doug, who you've been with for 2 decades. So, you know, this story is a happy one, and it is a happy thing to be able to share our story and our journey, and at the end of it to see that the road leads to, you know, when I think of the word finally, you know, in the cover of the book has a man with his arms stretched up, you know, you just kind of feel like you've arrived. And and how did you arrive, you know, to this place in your life? And I think there are many, many men and women out there that I hope will pick up your book and get some information about, you know, what that story was for you, and see how they could apply that to their own lives if they're struggling with coming out.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Amy. I want to convey a message of hope, because it, you know, you can get through some painful times and go to a life which is more authentic and quite happy.
Right. And, you know, and as we said earlier, you know, Lauren's story of saying, you know, people say, oh, it's so much easier now. You know, hey, it's each individual's life. And some person felt like their life was very easy in pioneer times, and some people think their life is very easy, you know, in a modern day. So it really is just about working through the stuff of this life. And Dr. Olson's book is a beautiful exploration of that, and also has some really great insights. So if you know somebody who is struggling, you know, living a double life, really struggling with coming to terms with being gay, you know, has a similar story in any way. Plus, it's just really good reading. It's a really interesting book, and you can get it, I'm sure, in any of your GLBT bookstores or independent bookstores in your town online. And also, there is a full website, finallyoutbook.com, which we will have linked in our show notes. But the book has been praised by, you know, definitely like the Men's Health of Boston director, and has also been, you know, reviewed by Publishers Weekly. So it is seen as an engaging and compelling book to telling this story of finally being out on the other side of a journey towards an authentic self. Dr. Olson, thank you so much for being on with us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. I greatly appreciate it.
Got something to say? Call us today. 312-21-BE-GAY. Well, I hope that you plan wonderful ways to be authentically yourself, be free, come out to somebody new every day this month. What a challenge to come out to someone every day for the entire month of June. I also want to say thank you to Oprah Winfrey for 25 wonderful years. You are already missed. Even though I'm watching reruns, it feels like you have not left. And I look forward to watching Fergie's live journey on OWN, the docuseries on Fergie, which the one on the Judds was so fantastic. But I am getting sad that perhaps the behind the scenes of Oprah are winding down, because there won't be any new episodes of Oprah from which they to go behind the scenes. But maybe they'll continue to unearth other behind the scenes episodes for us to watch and enjoy. But Oprah, thank you so much for 25 years. I have been inspired by you, and I appreciate what you've done as a woman and what you have done for us as LGBT people. You have been a huge advocate for us for decades, and we appreciate that, and appreciate the platform where you showed millions and millions of people our stories as well. So we will continue to watch and support you in all of your endeavors here on out. Have a great week, everyone. Thanks for listening to another Windy City Queercast. Special thanks to our Queercast family, Kirk Williamson, newscaster, and Di Sturkey, production editor. I'm Amy Matheny, your host. Please comment on our shows at WindyCityQueercast.com and iTunes. The next Queercast is only days away, so don't miss it. Subscribe today. Windy City Queercast, queer and now.
For quite some time, and this life is paralyzing. This life is paralyzing me.